Welcome to the Education Investment Podcast. In a world where investors are looking for stable and growing long-term returns with social impact, the education sector is becoming increasingly attractive. We speak to leading educators, operators, and investors in the education sector around the world to explore this growing investment theme alongside our listeners. From preschools to K-12 schools to higher education and vocational education, from edtech to education infrastructure, from VC investors to private equity and family offices, we explore it all. I'm your host, Monde Ngosi. Education has always been a big part of my life because my mother founded a school which was across the road from our home. I have benefited from excellent schools and teachers in South Africa and the US. I went on to study education and I'm now very grateful to be an investor in the sector that I love.
All opinions expressed by podcast guests are solely their own opinions. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Today, I'm privileged to host Ed Senior for a conversation on investing in schools. Many people don't think of schools as an investment sector, and yet it's a fast-growing sector with several large groups valued in the billions of dollars, backed by pools of institutional capital. Ed is the perfect person to help us break that all down. Ed spent over a decade in investment banking, most of that time being with Morgan Stanley in London and Dubai. He left banking in 2016 to join one of the world's largest independent school groups, serving more than 130,000 students. He was first in their corporate finance division, and ultimately, he was the group chief financial officer, or CFO. Ed has been instrumental in shaping my thinking around investing in schools and their infrastructure. Ed has roots in New Zealand and Australia, which are big sporting rivalries of my home country, of South Africa. So as much as it pains me to say it, Ed, I've really enjoyed working with you and I've learned a lot from you and benefited from your advice. Ed, it's lovely to have you. Welcome to the pod.
Thanks, Monty. Excited to be here.
Wonderful. Well, first off, Ed, we'd love to learn just about you and your journey before we get to matters about schools. So where did you grow up? What was your journey ultimately into the education path?
So Monde, born in the UK, raised in the Middle East, at least in part, lived all over the world as an adult, but the last 15 years in Dubai, here in the Middle East. So when people ask me where I'm from, I say Dubai now because it's easier than explaining all of that long journey. And I came into this sector completely by accident, if I'm honest. My mother was a primary school teacher in New Zealand, but I didn't know anything about education as a commercial enterprise until I came into GEMS, as you highlighted. You know, my background was in investment banking. I spent a couple of years in the wine industry. Monday, we'll talk about that some other time. But back in 2016, I was a director at Morgan Stanley. I'd made it through, you know, dot-com, the global financial crisis, Eurozone implosion, over 10 years at the front, and I was about ready for a new challenge. And I was asked by one of the private equity groups that was invested in GEMS to come and help them take the business public, to list it on the stock exchange. And look, for the audience, you mentioned it briefly, but for those who don't know GEMS, GEMS is a business with about 140,000 students today, around 60 schools, but with a real nexus to the Middle East, which is where my career had sort of developed and focused. And as you said, I joined as the head of corporate finance. After about 7 years of the business, I left as the group chief CFO and really enjoyed the time there. And look, as to what I enjoyed about the sector, you know, we're going to talk about the characteristics later in the pod, I'm sure, but this is a incredibly rewarding sector to be involved in. I really enjoyed being a banker, you know, did some cool deals, but after a while it gets a bit repetitive. And at a fundamental level in education, you're involved with these people who are hugely passionate, who've dedicated their careers to educating small people, building kids into future adults. And that's actually really humbling and really rewarding. And, you know, look, we all have bad days in the office. I challenge anybody to not walk through a corridor of kindergarten kids or 7, 8-year-olds who are all super pumped and excited and want to tell you about what's in the lunchbox and talk about Pokemon and not come away from that experience being, you know, really enthused and motivated to get on with the day and go back and deliver. And then, look, you know, final thought, I have small kids of my own and they all attended GEMS schools. And I was trying to think about this earlier. Is there another industry where you're so intimately connected with the product that you're, as a leader, in charge of delivering? And I can think of almost nothing else. maybe healthcare, but it does make you into a very involved stakeholder in this business. And that's super rewarding and super interesting as a space to work in professionally.
I didn't realize you had spent time also in the wine industry. I think I've also spent time in that industry, although maybe in a different capacity as a consumer. That was a whirlwind tour of your path. I'm fascinated that your mother was a teacher down in New Zealand. Was your dad in the education sector as well, or was something different? And did your mom teach in all these various parts of the world where you traveled?
No, she taught in the UK and she taught in New Zealand. My dad was a farmer ultimately. You know, I've got two dads. My parents are divorced, should be clear. One was a farmer, one's an engineer. But yeah, look, I have a huge amount of respect for educators, having seen what my mom's been through. My sister's also a teacher in New Zealand too. So I have an affinity for this space. But like I said, it's one of those spaces where, you know, everyone's been to school, but not everyone understands what schools are about. So it's an interesting perspective on that.
Absolutely. And maybe just a little bit more on your career path before we come to education in particular. So tell us a bit about the wine. That sounds like it should be fun. And then the investment banking. Was this before or after the investment banking or during?
Yeah, it was kind of in the middle. So in 2008, I made it through the financial crisis and I'd always hankered to go and do something in wine. Actually, one of the first deals I worked on as a banker was in the wine space, was working on a float of a business that makes a well-known New Zealand wine. I won't mention the brand. And, you know, post-financial crisis, I was a pretty young banker and wasn't so far up the ladder that I couldn't think about it, a different career. And I went back to university. I started for a master's degree in wine management, basically. Spent nearly 2 years working vintages all around the world, Australia, New Zealand, Chile, France, and ultimately gave it up. Not because I didn't enjoy wine or being a winemaker, but because my girlfriend, who's now my wife, wanted to get serious, settle down and have kids. And, you know, my former boss at Morgan Stanley kind of joked, like, if you leave, you'll never come back. And, you know, I picked up the phone to Morgan Stanley and they were gracious enough to set me back into the business after 2 years away. And that's how I resumed my career back at the bank. But it was a fantastic, look, professionally, if you ever have the chance to do a sort of sabbatical like this, it's an amazing experience to come away from and then come back to something. And, you know, I think very left brain, right brain side of life, right? You know, the wine's very creative. The banking's very, very math driven. So if you can do both in your career, you're winning.
That's really fascinating. Look, it adds to who you are as a human being. There's many sides to us other than our core role, as you very well know. So now that's really helpful context, and I appreciated that. And thanks for sharing about your family as well. Let's move on then to some of the main subject content of this discussion, which is investing in schools. I mentioned up front that many people don't think of schools as an investment sector. So let's go right to the beginning. Perhaps just give us the lay of the land. How wide or diverse is the sector? And what are some of the big groups?
Yeah, so the first thing to say, this is a huge and very, very fragmented marketplace. Now, we probably don't even know how many schools there are in the world right now. The data just doesn't exist. So UNESCO thinks there's about 2.5 billion school kids in the world. And so there's a lot of schools behind them. But if we click through the layers, you know, most schools or most children are educated by the state one way or the other. Of course, there's an unfortunate proportion of kids who get no education. But those who are in school, most of them are educated by the state. And then the size of the private sector really reflects what's going on in state provision globally. So to pick some bookends to that, if you pick like a big developed market like the UK, about 10% of school kids are in private education one way or another in the UK. At the other end of the marketplace, you've got a market like the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, where I live, and there it's more like 90% of kids are in private education, and that reflects the nature of the expatriate workforce here. So it does vary by market. Within the corner of the world that we think of as private K-12, there's also a huge amount of fragmentation itself. So you've got nonprofits, you've got, you know, faith-based education, so church-based schools, you've got sort of philanthropy, charities, and then you've got the kind of the true for-profit sector, which again is fragmented, so fragmentation cubed. In that marketplace, and we're sort of three levels down now, aren't we? You know, the top 10 operators probably represent no more than 10% of the underlying marketplace. Some of the bigger platforms are not necessarily well known as consumer brands. So businesses like Nord Anglia or Cognita or Inspired Education all operate globally. And then you've got some big regional champions like GEMS in the Middle East or Avatech or Karob in South Africa, who are all sort of operating in niche markets, but doing very good jobs of dominating the local opportunity set. What really unifies this sort of quite disparate business is that private equity has been a catalyst for consolidating and building the sector. So some of the world's largest PE firms have been in or currently own large stakes in these groups. So businesses like KKR, CVC, Blackstone have all been invested in the space, but also some investors that we associate more with infrastructure investments. So Canada Pension Plan or Stonepeak or Brookfield are also large investors in K-12 schools. It's also worth noting that you've got some big family groups invested in the space as well. So Cognita, one of the global groups that I mentioned, actually the largest investor there is a family called the Jacobs family, who is a Swiss private family who started their business interests in the coffee industry in Switzerland nearly 100 years ago. So it's a very disparate sector, but private equity, patient private capital is what sort of really binds it together.
Yeah, so many different layers. If we stay within the independent K-12 or school operators, and some of the ones that you mentioned there, you mentioned Nord Anglia's, Cognita's, ISPs, and that they only represent about 10% of that market. Just give me a sense: is this market all? So the other 90, as well as that 10 of those large groups, is this all $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year price points, or is there quite a wide variety of pupils or students that are served by independent schools?
Yeah, it's super diverse. By student numbers, the sort of affordable mid-market sector is actually a much, much larger marketplace. And, kind of by definition, those sort of elite selective private schools can only be so big. There can only be so many Eatons in the UK. And actually, in many instances, those schools are non-profits and they're sort of capped on capacity. So the market really isn't about those names or those price points. The commercial opportunity is really much more significant than that, much deeper than that in the sort of mid-market space. And the drivers, again, really driven by what's happening, as I mentioned earlier, in state provision of education. And don't get me wrong, as I said, my mom was a state school principal, so I have a huge amount of respect for what's happening in state provision. But look, compressed.
So was mine, incidentally. Ed.
Right. Well, there we go. Good company. So funding's been compressing, either in absolute terms, but definitely in real terms. Outcomes for students aren't great in many state systems. Parents want the best for their kids, sort of irrespective of the price points that they're at. And where they can afford to, they're going to look at, affordable private options if they have the capacity to do that. Just to put a number around it, GEMS had schools at all price points, but although we had schools at sort of $30,000, we also had schools at sort of $3,000. And the vast majority of students in the GEMS network were paying kind of less than $5,000-$6,000 a year for their education. So that big mid-market opportunity, I think, is very, very significant, and it's quite fundamental to what actually parents are choosing to do with their cash.
That's really fascinating, Ed, and the value that the parents get from it. Thinking that you mentioned some investors when you were talking there, KKR, CVC, Blackstone, those are some of the ones that you mentioned up front. And I mean, those are some of the world's premier private equity investors and also in real assets as well. So, for them to get out of bed for a sector, it has to be sizable and have some growth opportunities. So maybe give me a bit of a sense, some of the groups that you spoke about earlier, how big are these groups in whatever measure? A lot of them are private, so you wouldn't have market cap, but it could be the latest valuation or something along those lines. How big are these groups, and what do you think has attracted the likes of those investors to this sector?
Yeah, look, some of those large names actually publish their financials, so you can find this data readily if you dig around enough for it. But very many of them are delivering revenues in excess of, $1 billion, so up to sort of $2 billion earnings or EBITDA in the sort of the, $400-$500 million range. So they're very substantial commercial entities. And that's even by holding kind of 1% of the market, they're billion-dollar revenue businesses with pretty significant earnings. the earnings and the margins change a lot depending on where you look. It's driven a lot by kind of price points and where they operate. We'll talk about that a bit more later. But look, this is a really interesting space for these investors. If you think about it just as a sort of an asset class on the demand side, you've got this sort of globally growing aspirational parent body as middle classes sort of expand incrementally each year, who see investment in their kids' future as being, you know, something they really want to prioritize in their earnings stack. And again, you know, state provision's getting weaker, staffing's challenged, infrastructure's weak. And so you've got this kind of real demand pull, which PE has noticed and, you know, leads them to sort of look at this sector as something that's really interesting. On the business side, you know, this is a market where you've got really sticky underlying demand. You know, we're not quite immune to the business cycle, but we're definitely very resilient. We're certainly insulated from the worst of the business cycle. And as to stickiness, you know, if you do a good job with your customers, and customers can change course very quickly, so you have to do a good job, you know, customers can spend 12, 14 years with you through their schooling careers. And then you've got these sort of very high barriers to entry. This is a market where having a lot of capital, having a great reputation, being able to deliver consistently on academic outcomes is really important. And so those earnings coming out of this for the private equity groups have got, you know, sort of a nice big moat around them, which is, you know, really attractive to those businesses that are putting capital to work here. And then finally, look, this is a market where like scale really matters. Large operators can generally deliver better educational outcomes, we think, better systems, better recruitment practices, better investment than the smaller standalone operators. And so pull that together, you've got this sort of steadily growing, really resilient, sticky, defensive earnings pool that's really attractive to private equity. And that's why these businesses have grown to be so big as they are, just through consolidation, through you know, buying out the market and through developing as well their own greenfield assets.
That's great. You know, I think of that, you mentioned 12 to 14 years that a student stays with you if you're doing a good job. And I try to think of analogs. What other investments can have that kind of long-term visibility? You think of it in the software world, if you've got 3-year contracts or along those lines, and people refer to recurring revenue a lot, you know, you're in a good place. Or if you've got 5-year contracts, this is on another level altogether. 12 to 14 years, it probably, as I think about it, is more analogous to infrastructure investments. If you own a toll road or something, that's the sort of length of term. And it really is exceptional as a sector for that stickiness and resilience, as long as the operator is doing a good job.
And actually shares a lot more with infrastructure. You know, the sort of the pricing that sort of CPI plus, you know, it's very, very rare to see school prices go down. Those also parents and pay the bills know that. That low volatility of earnings is very infrastructure-like. You know, in some markets, you've got a little bit of regulatory overplay, but, you know, they're sort of unregulated utilities, but without the kind of the volume and price volatility you get from other parts of real assets. So, you know, I mentioned this earlier, but it's not surprising that you see these big investment houses, you know, like Canada Pension Plan or Brookfield, who've got their origins in you know, real assets and origins in infrastructure, you know, toll roads and airports and other real assets internationally, looking at infrastructure around schools and coming to believe that this is very real asset style return profile.
The other side of that, which I'm interested to explore, is whether a lot of these names are private or public. If you have a 12 to 14 year time horizon, I mean, I've worked in public markets. I don't know all that many public market investors that have that kind of time horizon. So are most of these groups private or public? Are there any that are large and public? And just why do you think that is?
So the short answer is not yet. There are a handful of listed education peers. Usually they're focused on one market rather than these kind of big global platforms. So, you know, in South Africa, as we mentioned, you've got Coro and Avatech both being listed. In the Middle East, you've got a great business called Talim, which was a fierce competitor of James and a really, really high quality business. In China, there's a gaggle of kind of K-12 businesses, somewhat different, listed in Hong Kong, who frankly have been disrupted by regulatory change there and sort of a shadow of their former self. Look, notwithstanding that, there's almost certainly going to be more in future. Those large private equity groups that own these assets will one day look for liquidity. And these businesses are getting so big now that, you know, kind of the public markets is a natural avenue for them to exit into. So I wouldn't be surprised to see listings from some of those large groups in future. Inspired is being widely rumored to have looked at a listing. Nord Anglia was listed in the US until 2017 when it's bought back by the current PE consortium. look, why aren't they listed? Why aren't more listed? You know, I think these businesses are kind of in rapid growth mode at the moment. Perhaps that's a little bit easier to do behind closed doors, particularly if you're doing it with a lot of financial leverage. But I think these will make great public businesses in due course. And if you think about what other listed businesses that share some of those characteristics, right? You know, relatively high EBITDA margins, low volatility of earnings, kind of steady compounding growth. They're trading on, you know, like high teens, kind of low 20s EBITDA multiples. So I think there's an attractive, you know, market of buyers out there who look at these assets, and there's no reason why it can't be fairly valued in the public market as well in due course.
That's really interesting. And you mentioned that they're in growth mode, which would make it's easier to do that in the private market than in the public. So maybe that just leads us on to a conversation a bit about the financial profile. As these groups are growing, is growth here capital intensive? Is it not capital intensive? Is it, what's the working capital like? Do you need to invest a lot in working capital as these groups are growing? So maybe just talk us through the financial profile and how that differs over the life cycle of a school group.
So if we go through the P&L, sort of top to bottom, and here I'm thinking about the kind of the global average private school rather than picking a specific operator, you know, on revenue, to your question on working capital is great because your parents actually pay you in advance before the start of the school term, which means you start with a positive cash balance, which you run down through the term and then replenish at each term the interval.
So I know the pains of that as a parent.
Yeah. great for operators. It's a tough check for parents to write, but great for operators. The largest expense on the expenses side is staff, and you know, rightly so. Teachers, teaching assistants, education, leadership, principals, you know, right through to cleaners and admin staff in the schools. You know, that can be, depending on the model, depending on the margins, depending on the market, you know, up to 50, 60, 70% of your cost base. After that, you've got what we call admin expense, which is basically everything else. So, you know, pencils through heat, light, power. Rent, depending on, you know, we'll come back to sort of asset intensity, but rent can be sort of 10, 15% of your revenue, ultimately, depending on whether you own the business or you lease it. And then you're generally spending kind of 3 to 4% of revenue a year on maintenance, CapEx, and then taxes and debt service after that. Look, profitability at the net income level, you know, the schools should be profitable. Even the non-profits or the state, they have to make a surplus. So in the for-profit sector, you know, margins can vary, but, you know, 10, 15% net income margins or 20 to 30% EBITDA margins, not unheard of, and can change a lot depending on, you know, price point and markets that you serve. I think, you know, parents sometimes look at those returns askew, and it's understandable. You know, people have views about for-profit education, but I think those returns need to be balanced against your very, very high capital intensity for the sector. You can genuinely spend as much money as you want building a new school. GEMS, my old employer, is press, is spending, you know, over $100 million on a new school in Dubai right now. And so the returns are really kind of paying for that quite expensive infrastructure if you put the school on your balance sheet. And so really we should be thinking about kind of ROIC or ROE or the kind of the IRRs you're developing on that big upfront CapEx. And bear in mind, you know, schools are very stable once they're complete, but getting to complete is a many, many year journey, up to 10 years to get a brand new school up to sort of peak capacity and operating at full. And that's in a growth market, you know, maybe break even by kind of year 3, 4, 5. And in the meantime, you're absorbing losses, which also add to your kind of capital intensity in the front end, and, you know, maybe washing your face by year sort of 6, 7. So again, you know, this is one of the reasons why private capital works well in this space. You do need patience to live with that return profile. We're at the other end of the spectrum to the quick wins from crypto and Mag 7. So, you know, you need to have a long threshold, and you need to be patient, and you need to kind of see those returns over the horizon.
And maybe if you just break down a little bit into layman's terms. So I put, in this case, it was $100 million. I think that's a high number. Let's say $20 million down into building a school. Do I build that all on day one, or is it built in stages? And then you said it can take up to 10 years for that to be full. So do you only offer certain grades and then you grow up, or you offer all grades and then it just takes 10 years for them to fill up? Just practically, how does this happen for new schools?
Yeah, you got it. So in a market like Dubai, where you're growing with a growing population base, so you're not dependent on share take from a static population base, but where you're growing against a growing kind of demand line, the way we think about building new schools is that they're going to fill up from the bottom up. So most kids will join a school. The beginning of their school journey is kind of kindergarten kids. And so when you open a new school, you're really building out the primary sections of the school. And those kids are enrolling in kind of kindergarten through year 3, 4, 5. And then next year, they'll matriculate into the next year, and you'll bring in another cohort of kindergarten kids behind them. And like that, over year and year and year and year, you build up the school from the kind of the bottom upwards. And yes, there'll be a little bit of kind of parents switching into new schools with older kids. But really, the way you build a new school, at least in these sort of high growth markets, is by infilling the primary schools. And so just mathematically, it takes time to kind of build a school up to where you've got an equal number of kids in year 12, 13, 14, as it is if you had started, you know, you started a brand new school. And look, that's one of the drivers of this kind of long maturity profile. The schools take time to fill up because the kids take time to come to you. And in the meantime, you are, you know, you're still running the full school. To your question on phasing, yeah, I mean, in Dubai, it's very common for schools to be built essentially as kind of a primary school first. And you'll build some of the core infrastructure that supports secondary school. But over time, you'll build those more secondary, you know, centric functions like the bigger science labs or the bigger sports hall. But you'll start with an auditorium. You'll start with a swimming pool. You'll start with what can support a primary school in the beginning. And look, you know, it's worth noting that schools in Dubai are a bit bigger than they are globally. It's not uncommon to see schools with 2,000 kids in them. The markets, you know, schools in the UK can be a couple of hundred kids with much smaller class sizes, much fewer classes per year group, and then the economics change again. But just think about it as a journey from a parent's perspective. You know, the risk of moving your kids into a new school is quite high. And so you only start taking share from competitors. Once you've proved that academic track record out, parents are a bit more willing to try a new school with younger kids because they always sort of feel they can switch later. But moving a 16-year-old into a brand new school or a 14-year-old into a brand new school is pretty risky for parents if they've got other options.
Look, I'm a father of two myself, as you well know, so 100% get that. You, as long as the school's delivering well, good quality academics, and your child is happy, which is also important, then you don't want to move them. There were a couple of acronyms you used as you were talking about the financial profile of the business, and you went through the income statement and some of the key balance sheet items. And you mentioned it all comes back ultimately to ROIC, return on invested capital, or ROE, or your return on equity. So maybe just give us a sense, either on return on invested capital or return on equity, to be able to justify the high teen or low 20s EBITDA multiples you spoke about previously. What kind of returns can you expect from a generic education group? I know that's a hard question, but you can give me some sort of range, combined with the very long-term then horizon and stability.
Yeah, look, I personally think at maturity, you want to be delivering a kind of 20% ROIC in this space. And I think that's a good reward for the risks of that long-term capital and for the kind of the pathway that it gets to. And let's assume, you know, these businesses are being benchmarked against costs of capital in the kind of high single digits, low teens. That's a sort of a spread over your cost of capital of kind of 8%, something like that. That for me feels like an appropriate return for investors in this space. And when operators benchmark, you know, kind of new schools, I think they're looking for that sort of IRR and the, you know, cash on cash outcomes. The risk is more to the timing than it is to the fundamental outcome. I think that most schools will get to full, given sort of the underlying demand profiles here. But the risk is whether you get to full in year 5 or whether you get to full in year 15. And that can have quite a different, you know, return profile for investors, even if you sort of fundamentally get there in the end. But yeah, like, you know, ROICs of 20%, I don't think are unreasonable for this space. One of the things that changes that a lot is the capital intensity of the schools, you know, depending on how much of the asset base is on your balance sheet, that can change your ROIC pretty fundamentally. You know, some of the better operators out there are increasingly asset light. And so they're essentially leasing assets, which essentially levers the returns, and you know, that can deliver ROICs that are far in excess of that. And I think that's kind of probably more attractive for the public markets.
That's interesting. Perhaps let me follow you down there. So when you went through the income statement, you mentioned rent. So maybe just talk about that, the different models that schools can approach to owning versus leasing their school properties.
It's very easy to spend $20-30 million on a new school if you include all the phases. And I think the question for operators is that a cost that should sit on your balance sheet or not? Or can you rent that from a third party who's looking for, you know, also stable long-term returns in the space, but who perhaps will lease that to you so you can get on with owning the operating assets of the school rather than the bricks and mortar, which are kind of dead assets after a while. I mean, sort of, they don't do anything for you as an operator. And look, you know, there are operators out there who have a lot of assets on balance sheet, and there are operators out there who are increasingly asset light. James, we're somewhere in the middle. We own about half of our schools, and the other half we leased from developers. But, you know, Nord Anglia at one end of the spectrum is I think it's got the asset model just right. They're very asset light. And I think that inflates the, you know, returns on capital that they're delivering, even with the incremental rent expense running through the P&L, and something, you know, that in some parts reflects the margins of the business. You know, they're able to deliver these sort of very high returns on invested capital by basically putting the biggest chunk of capital in the school's business onto somebody else's balance sheet and renting it back from them.
Mm, that's so interesting. And you take Nord Anglia as the example. I've always thought of them as the sort of the pioneer of the asset light model in education. Just taking, you know, public numbers, I think it was an FT article in the last transaction that they did, valued at about a $15 billion business. So I think they've done tremendously well and have done a lot for the sector. If I just continue to stay on this point of leasing, you know, you think of leasing in a lot of sectors. You've got malls, you've got apartments, all that stuff we're used to. But schools are different. You mentioned, you know, 12, 14 years, each student is going to be there, and there's going to be generations of students. So this is a far more longer term industry than others. So how does that translate then into the requirements of what schools need from a partner on the real estate or infrastructure side of this, if they're going to lease from you?
I think one of the key differentiators for landlords out there is the ability to grow with the school. You know, I mentioned that these landlords or these schools are being developed in phases, right? So you build your primary school first, and then after sort of 4 or 5 years, you'll build an extension, which some of your middle school kids will grow into. And then over time, maybe you extend that further and add sort of more spaces for the big kids to crash around it. I think landlords that can partner with you on that journey, and that's really interesting for operators. It's a different model.
I think the first step of partnership, Ed, would be not calling them landlords. That doesn't sound like a partnership to me.
but you know, I think it is a different model from the way in which, let's say, warehouses are owned or office buildings are owned. And I think you need a different perspective from the asset owners, let's call them, who are in the space here. And I think, you know, the other element is understanding the kind of the timelines of these assets. If you build an office building on day one, you pretty much have it mostly full, right? You'll try and get tenants to take all of the space from the outset. It will be rare to have an office building where you bank on filling it over 10 years and maybe it being kind of 20% utilized in its first year of operation. And so it is a return profile that's going to be different to most landlords, and sort of will look slightly different. But the counterpoint to that is you don't have the volatility of commercial counterparties, right? You know, schools are stable and that demand is sticky, and it's unlikely that you get the sort of volatility that you would get from, I know, kind of a commercial tenant who's there for 3 years and maybe they relocate their offices or maybe everyone works from home. So it's going to be a different kind of profile of the partners you have on the other side of the table. But, you know, I think for a landlord, you get an incredibly high quality credit on the other side of the table. Mm. And, you know, the asset light operators out there, I think, have sort of proved how, you know, they can sort of weather tough financial markets and tough conditions, probably in a way that your average tenant just doesn't. And I think that's attractive.
Mm, I think that's proven out also in the data. You know, there are a few education infrastructure funds which are listed in various parts of the world, in Mexico and Australia and a few others, and I've had a look at some of those, looked at them through COVID, looked at them through the global financial crisis, and if you compare them to pretty much any other segment of real estate, I mean, it's the stability is off the charts. A school is not going to move its location because of COVID or even the global financial crisis unless that school already wasn't working before, you know, but a good functioning working finishing school doesn't move because of that. So absolutely, I think that's been proven out by the data, that stability over time. So I guess the secret sauce in all of this is choosing the right operators to work with, because that's what provides the stability. If the academic outcomes are not good or anything else, then you will have, you know, the likelihood of moving or parents leaving. So yeah, it's absolutely a fascinating sector of this or section of this overall sector. Maybe then if I come a bit to the returns and the horizon, Ed, because you've mentioned in a few different places, so I'm going to bring a few different things together. You mentioned these school groups, if they own their real estate, should be earning at least a 20% ROIC over the long term, and even higher if they're not owning their real estate, if they're leasing. So let's, for argument's sake, say 25-30% or return on invested capital. One of the things that's quite challenging is thinking of the effects of compounding. So a 20% return sounds like something you could potentially get in other sectors. But what's the kind of horizon you would think of when saying a school can earn a 20% return over, you know, or a school group, over what kind of horizon, and what impact does that have to the compounding over time?
If you think about what schools do well, they do it particularly well if you have a portfolio of them. So if you have a portfolio of schools who are basically some early in their journey, probably loss making initially, and then you have a cohort of schools that are sort of washing their face, and then you have a cohort of schools who are mature, the cash flows from the mature schools are essentially funding your development assets. And there's, as you kind of allude to, there's nothing so elegant as compounding your internal capital, right? And so if you can pump out free cash from your mature schools who've kind of washed their face and paid off that sort of development period and reinvest that in new assets, that's really where returns on equity get sort of ramped pretty quickly. And, you know, again, sort of thinking about how these assets can be valued in the public markets, I think a lot of the times they look like these stocks that we call compounders, right? Businesses with relatively modest capital requirements that are sort of constantly reinvesting retained earnings back into growth. And those are businesses that have been, you know, like fantastic returns for investors in the public markets. And I always thought, you know, that was really the job of the capital stewards of these businesses is to sort of generate free cash flow streams and then reinvest it in sort of future growth, particularly given that big opportunity set that we sort of allude to go and get in front of that sort of moving trend of middle-class aspirational parents.
Yeah, I think it's an extraordinary opportunity. I recently had a look at what were the 10 most valuable companies 30 years ago, and what are the 10 most valuable companies now? And the list is completely different. Most of the top 10 today actually didn't exist 30 years ago. If you think of you've got on that list the Microsofts and the Apples and the Metas, etc. And yet in schools, just because things move so much slower, if you've got a high quality operator, you know, the school I went to is over 100 years old. The school the primary school my daughter is at is I think 125 years old or so this year. That compounding over that long a period and that level of stability, I think is an absolutely extraordinary opportunity. Now, you don't have to stay 120 years to wait for those returns, obviously, but even just over 15, 20, 25 years, compounding at 20% has a huge impact on returns. And very few investors, I mean, I work in the investment industry, as you know, across any sector or any asset class, can achieve a 20% return over a two-decade period, let alone, you know, 25, 30 years. It really is extraordinary. Another thing that you've mentioned, Ed, a few times is different price points. And you've mentioned that you've referred to the model differing depending on where you are. So maybe let's just double click a bit on that. In what respect do the business models differ depending on, you know, is this a $30,000 a year school fee school or $3,000?
Yeah, look, I think ultimately, you know, schools are guided by what parents want. And there are a cohort of parents who, frankly, are quite wealthy and have, you know, resources to put behind education that includes a lot of sporting activities, a lot of after school activities, a very broad curricula, who want, you know, ski trips in Verbier and who want, you know, sort of trips to the Met. But let's be clear, right? The core
equestrian was the first thing that came to mind, Ed.
Right, exactly. And look, I fantastic, right? You know, good for those kids to have that opportunity set. But at the core, most parents care about you know, the things I think we all remember from our own schools, right? Sort of, you know, English, math, science, the arts and humanities. And what really differentiates schools is sort of the mid-market price point and the premium price point is two things. One is the breadth of the curriculum. And so you'll be doing, it's very expensive to teach equestrian studies, right? Not everyone in the school want to do it. The horse is expensive. But equally delivering, you know, kind of physics or maths in a course setting is quite cost effective. And so what you'll find is schools that are in the mid-market space have got a curriculum that's focused on what parents are really, you know, kind of care about. So we're here to deliver, you know, English, math, science, the arts and humanities. And, you know, what's really impressive from my experience, you know, working in the sector is just how creative schools are delivering the incremental experience for kids, even at the price points where maybe the infrastructure isn't there. I remember very clearly one of our schools, you know, they didn't have the money for a brand new all singing and dancing film studio to be able to do media studies. So they painted a broom cupboard green. And that was the green space for the kids to do, you know, video editing. And look, that works, right? And so just because these schools are at a more modest price point doesn't mean that they can't deliver really innovative and inventive education, particularly with technology now, which is a great enabler of you know, an experiential experience in school. I'm not even, is that a thing, experiential experience? We'll find out. But you know, these are you know, sort of force multipliers, if you like, right? They give you opportunity to kind of to push the envelope in a way that probably would have been much more expensive in the past. So breadth of curriculum is one. And the other is obviously the quality of the infrastructure. A mid-market school might not have a swimming pool because parents, if they want the kids to swim, are quite happy to pay for that out of school. Maybe the kids do it out of school at somewhere else. In a premium school, parents will probably expect to have an Olympic-sized swimming pool and, you know, all the other amenities that go with that. But really, if you're building a mid-market school, it's not core to what parents want. And you can focus down on the stuff that is important to them and make sure that that's delivered really well. I think it's really important to say that quality of delivery shouldn't be different. And actually, studies I've seen show that mid-market schools can deliver outcomes that are at or ahead of the public space in particular. And it's sort of really heartening to see, you know, kids who are spending, you know, $3,000-$5,000 on their education, or the parents are putting that money to work, going to tier one global institutions in their, you know, tertiary university careers because they've come out of school with sort of 4 A levels or A stars. Bright kids will excel. And we should be making sure they've got an opportunity to excel, irrespective of what their parents can pay. And that's, I think, you know, an important part of what good operators can do.
That's great. That's great, Ed. One other segment of this, as you said, it's a very diverse sector. And one segment of it that we haven't spoken about yet is the partnerships that different school groups get into. So, for instance, I've seen models which it's not often referred to as franchising, but it's almost akin to franchising. If I take the Harrow schools, for instance, there's, off the top of my head, call it 15 or so Harrow schools across Asia, not just the one in the UK. And those are done in partnership with others. And there's many others, mainly British brands are the one that I've come across, which then expand into other parts of the world. Can you maybe just touch on that segment a little bit and a bit about how the various models work?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting way to enter new markets, particularly if you are entering a market where academic success is sort of paramount. Walking into a new market with a brand name of excellence behind you kind of shortcuts a lot of those questions that parents might have about the provenance or the ability of a school to deliver. It's obviously incumbent on operators to make sure that that's not just a brand being stuck over the top. And I think, to be fair, most operators who are using other people's brand names or, you know, licensing those trademarks, if you like, from overseas, you know, do a good job of that. Where it works really well, I've seen operators actually try and tie the schools quite closely to the home market. So, you know, I've seen things like video assemblies or video lectures where the schools are kind of tied together with the outlying branches. I think that's really innovative and something that technology can enable, which probably wasn't, you know, possible a couple of years ago. I think you can deepen that however you want to, right? You know, schools that can move their staff between you know, say the UK outpost and a newly developed site who can bring that kind of pedagogy, you know, across the various parts of the business. And again, this sort of speaks to scale, right? You know, businesses that have got scale can do this in a way that, that it's difficult for single operators to do. You know, I think parents really appreciate the idea that, you know, the school principal, the founding principal came from the mothership. And maybe they weren't the principal, maybe they were deputy principal, but this is a great opportunity for them to transition their skills. So look, I think it's a really interesting, you know, way to do it. Not everyone goes this way. There are plenty of people who have independent brand names, plenty of schools that exist in new markets that don't have a Harrow or other tier one UK or US, you know, Dwight or a Repton sort of attached to it. But I think it's a smart way for operators to leverage that to get instant recognition and traction. And if they do it well, I think it's for the benefit of everybody.
We've spoken, this is an investment podcast, so we've spoken a lot about the investment side of schools, which I think is somewhat underappreciated. But when you think more broadly about the independent school sector, so rather than any single operator, the independent school sector as a whole, how do you think about the social impact of that sector?
You know, teachers are a unique bunch, and, you know, they have an impact on the community that the we underprice massively and underappreciate, certainly. And, you know, you and I have both got teachers as parents, so we know that. But I think your average parent probably doesn't think very deeply about what it is that the teachers add to the community. I think we need to get away from the idea that only the state, you know, can deliver social impact. I think that or the state or the charitable sector, you know, they both do great jobs, but there was enough provision in the independent charitable space or in the state, you know, the private sector wouldn't exist. And that's clearly not the case, right? I think that the private sector can coexist alongside, you know, state systems to deliver social outcomes. I think, you know, we can talk about that at the extreme end, sort of scholarships and access, but even just, you know, kind of providing incremental supply and capacity to a marketplace that the state frankly just can't afford to deliver or can't afford to deliver well. I think, you know, that the private sector is fulfilling a function here in the same way that private hospital operators are fulfilling a function.
Look, the lens I think of it through, if I just take my own country here in my home country, South Africa, the World Bank and the Development Bank of Southern Africa did a study recently, probably about 2 years ago, and they estimate just on the education infrastructure in South Africa. South Africa would need to spend an additional 5% of GDP per annum. I can't quite remember the total, but that ends up being 2 trillion rand by 2030 or some huge number. There is no feasible way that the state can fund that itself. So you've got to somehow get private capital involved. And it's very hard to get private capital involved, most of which comes from pension funds, you know, the things that everyone's going to retire off, if there isn't a commercially viable model that earns a reasonable return on capital. So nothing, not excessive, not egregious, but it's got to earn a reasonable return on capital. And ultimately, those are the pensions that belong to me, you, you know, your mother, my mother, and every other South African here. So that's the lens that I've thought of it through, Ed.
I think it's worth noting that the asset base of schools is really the people, right? The educators, yes, are the asset base of the school.
Yes.
The bricks and mortar are nice and they're important and they can be a tool for generating returns, but ultimately the people are what's important. And there aren't enough teachers in the world, right? There's a huge constraint on teacher availability. The private sector educates a huge number of teachers. GEMS used to grow its own assets. We used to, you know, celebrate promoting and giving opportunities to teaching assistants who wanted to become full-time teachers. We had our own educational development team. You know, we had our own education qualification granting body, which could help people transition into full-time educational careers if they wanted to. You know, there aren't enough teacher training colleges in the world. And if the private sector is not involved there either, that challenge on educational teacher supply is going to get more acute. So I think we're all invested in the outcome here. We all want our kids to be, you know, engaged and given opportunities. And as you say, there just isn't enough capital in the government space to do that alone.
You've got a lot of experience. You've done due diligences. You've acquired schools. You've built schools from scratch. If you were talking to an investor who's new to this sector, so, you know, keeping it at a fairly high level, what are some of the big risks that you'd say they should be aware of when investing in schools?
Yeah, I don't want to say the sector is without risk. by any means, but really the acid test was COVID. And global operators really weathered essentially schools being shut down and going to remote learning and online provision, you know, really well. And I sort of think if you can survive that, then everything else is going to be kind of a footnote, right? Especially if your client base is in that kind of mid-market space, sort of, you know, sticky, resilient, local end customer who probably isn't a sort of globally mobile expatriate. You know, I think that actually the demand side of your business is pretty secure. Look, you know, there are operating challenges like every business. You know, in some markets, you're dealing with regulatory oversight. You know, in China, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the business model of some of the mainland Chinese operators was impacted by, you know, quite a fundamental change to who could and couldn't attend international schools and effectively, you know, derailed the model of a lot of the listed businesses there. But I think that's by no means universal. You know, by and large, regulators want more, want better schools, and they're generally aligned with you, right? They see the function that the private sector delivers, in my experience at least. The other big challenge we mentioned, you know, teacher availability, not enough teachers in the world. Again, big visible businesses like the private chains, frankly, have an edge in recruitment. You know, teachers can see the brands, can see the opportunity that they can get through working in those larger businesses. So that's the risk that is somewhat defrayed in the larger end of town. It's a lot easier to recruit if you're a Cognita or Inspired or GEMS or Nord Anglia than it is if you're a single operator in a far-flung market. And then finally, I'd say capital formation. There's a huge opportunity here, but building a school takes a while. It does need that patient capital. You know, it's interesting. You know, lots of people can spot the opportunity here, but it is interesting in the grand scheme of things how little institutional capital really is invested in the industry. You know, for the top 10 operators are owning 10% of the space. That's unusual. That's not replicated in lots of other markets and verticals globally. And I think that speaks to, you know, the kind of the unique requirements of capital in this space. So not risks, but operational challenges to overcome.
That's great. Thanks, Ed. And the final question on the schools topic is just looking forward. As you look forward, are there any specific geographic areas that you're excited about for this opportunity or purely a global opportunity or any verticals that you think are particularly well poised? What's exciting you?
Yeah, look, this is a really global opportunity, right? And I think it's worth, you know, one has to sort of zoom out and look at that global market. I think there are different bits of the market that are more or less prospective at any particular point in time. You know, if you just sort of think about the global market, it's sort of three main archetypes. You've got markets like Singapore and Dubai, which, you know, exist really because private schools are there to support a big expatriate population that maybe don't have access to, or where the expectations of the parents don't match what's available from the state system. That's the largest market opportunity at the moment in terms of sort of raw dollars. And then so the next archetype is the sort of markets where, you know, private schools are there really to educate domestic students, where it's more about, you know, parents wanting more in terms of resources or class sizes and the state can deliver. And that's, you know, the traditional kind of UK, US, but also Spain, maybe South Africa's in that bucket as well. And then thirdly, there's a really interesting market that personally I'm quite excited by, which is where you have this sort of international English language, but also bilingual English and then another sort of language provision. And that's really for kind of a middle class who are breaking into this market, if you like, who want to give their kids the broadest opportunity set globally to go to college in the US, the UK, or Australia. And you can think of markets like, you know, Latin America, Vietnam and Thailand in that sort of bracket. And really the first and the third are probably the most interesting for me. You know, I think, you know, the high growth markets like Dubai are obviously interesting because you've got the sort of the raw population growth underlying it. But that sort of third, you know, archetype I talked about, the kind of the increasing penetration in these sort of middle income jurisdictions like, you know, like kind of Mexico or Argentina, you know, Vietnam or Thailand, I think are really, really interesting. You know, I used to think a lot about like where do teachers want to go and teach next is a good indicator for sort of where the market's hot. And I think there's a lot of interest from teachers to go and work in Vietnam and Thailand right now, not least because they're great places to live, but also because the opportunity there for their profession is really, really hot at the moment.
That's wonderful. Ed, look, this was an absolute masterclass on investing in schools. I really, really appreciate it. Coming back now to you, and I ask the same question to all our guests, the same concluding question. And that's, please tell us about your favorite teacher or educator.
Yeah, I should really say my mom, shouldn't I? I hope she doesn't listen to this. But my sister's also a teacher, so she's up there for contention. But I'm actually going to highlight one of my son's teachers, and I'm not going to name him because I think that would be unfair. But this is a little bit of a story, so bear with me. So, you know, during my COVID, my son, like many other kids globally, was doing remote learning. And to be fair, I think he found it quite tough. It was quite an emotional time for all of us, but he found it quite emotional to not be in a classroom setting. I was sitting in my office one day on a Zoom, and then next to me was my son doing a Zoom sort of in parallel with his teacher. And at the end of his lesson, my son's teacher stayed on for sort of 10, 15 minutes to check in with him on how he was doing emotionally. And I think he'd noticed that he was sort of doing it tough, as we'd say. And he spent that sort of 10, 15 minutes almost like decompressing, you know, my boy. And he couldn't see that I was in the room, but I was sort of listening in and sort of watching carefully what was happening. And I think at that moment, it really kind of clicked for me what actually great educators do for us and for our kids. Sure, the academics are important, and that's critical that they learn maths and science and English and all the other things. But really, that sort of pastoral care is so critical to what it is that teachers deliver. And we don't give any value to that. And I think parents, you know, really struggle to recognize what it is that they're getting out of the system. You know, we're entrusting our teachers to grow our kids into adults on behalf of us. And it's an incredible skill set. And I'm in awe of people who do it for a living. And so I'll highlight that teacher, but because I had a chance to sort of see it live in action. But really, I think most teachers just take that for granted. That's part of their day job. And I think we should all spend more time recognizing what it is that they do for our kids.
That's extraordinary. A beautiful tribute, really, to that teacher. Ed, thank you so much for your time today. It's been really fun. And as I said, it's been an absolute masterclass on investing in schools. So I'll see you soon. And thanks for coming, Ed.
Great. Thanks. Enjoy the chat, Monty. All the best.
Thank you for listening. We really value your support. This episode was brought to you by Education Partners, a leading investor in school and tertiary campus properties, and a trusted long-term partner to exceptional education groups. For more information, visit www.edu.partners. That's edu.partners.